This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, July 2nd, 2008. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, The American Melody of A.R. Ammons. By most reckonings, A.R. Ammons was one of the best American poets of the second half of the 20th century. When he died in 2001, he was a fixture of the literary establishment that he'd always distrusted. He was never part of any literary school, but nonetheless, as you'll hear in a moment, he has a distinctly American voice. Stephen Burt recently wrote a reading guide to A.R. Ammons that you can find on our website, poetryfoundation.org. Steve is a poet and critic who teaches at Harvard, where he joins me from his office. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
So A.R. Ammons is the only poet I can think of, I don't know if you can think of others, who was trained as a chemist. How do you think that comes out in his work?
Well, he understands intuitively, and he's often reminding us, that there are laws and forms of order by which the whole world, the whole universe operates.
Yeah.
And Ammons, partly because he had such a thorough grounding in the natural sciences, and in chemistry in particular, is relatively comfortable with the idea that there's just a bunch of consciousnesses and a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Ammons, in his ability to live with, not to get angry about, the way that the immutable laws of nature do not care whether we live or die or decay or flourish. In Ammons' ability to live with that, he resembles no other poet so much as he resembles the poets we associate with East Asian doctrine. Gary Snyder, for example.
He's very similar to Gary Snyder, I think.
And yet, Ammons never sounds like Snyder, and Ammons is extremely interested in reason.
Yeah, a typical Ammons poem actually makes an argument. It seems to always be making an argument to me.
We're going to hear
one that makes a very clear argument, and it's a poem that he read at the 92nd Street Y in New York City in 1996. It's called Still, though Ammons apparently had some doubts about that title.
Hmm.
And let me play it for you.
This next poem is my wife's favorite, or I guess my favorite of my poems. I call it Still, and she insists that it should be called The Lowly, and I think she's right. Still. Excuse me. The Lowly. I said I will find what is lowly and put the roots of my identity down there. Each day I'll wake up and find the lowly nearby, a handy focus and reminder, a ready measure of my significance, the voice by which I would be heard, the wills, the kinds of selfishness I could freely adopt as my own. But though I have looked everywhere, I can find nothing to give myself to. Everything is magnificent with existence, is in surfeit of glory. Nothing is diminished. Nothing has been diminished for me. I said, what is more lowly than the grass? Ah, underneath, a ground crust of dry burnt moss. I looked at it closely and said, this can be my habitat. But nestling in, I found below the brown exterior green mechanisms beyond intellect awaiting resurrection and rain. So I got up and ran, saying, there is nothing lowly in the universe. I found a beggar. He had stumps for legs. Nobody was paying him any attention. Everybody went on by. I nestled in and found his life. There, love shook his body like a devastation. I said, though I have looked everywhere, I can find nothing lowly in the universe. I whirled through transfigurations up and down, transfigurations of size and shape and place. At one sudden point came Still, stood in wonder, moss, beggar, weed, tick, pine self, magnificent with being.
A.R. Ammons reading Still, which was recorded before a live audience at New York's 92nd Street Y. Now, the argument that he's making here, Steve, mm-hmm. is that there's no hierarchies in nature.
That's right.
He's out to find what's higher or lower, and he looks at the grass, which is low, and looks underneath the grass at the moss, which is low, and finds it all beautiful.
It's all beautiful, and it's all got its own systems, and it's all worthy of respect. Now, that poem Still, gives you Ammons, I don't want to say at his most argumentative, but at his most declarative, at his most, I would like to say, Whitman-esque.
I was going to say, this seems like a rewriting of Whitman in many respects.
It is very much everything, a rewriting of Whitman.
He's talking about grass. Whitman wrote poems about grass, wrote a whole book, Leaves of Grass, and tried to destroy hierarchies as society found them during his time. And he also did a Whitman-esque turn when he identifies and enters into the beggar.
I found a beggar. He had stumps for legs. Nobody was paying him any attention. Everybody went on by. I nestled in and found his life. There, love shook his body like a devastation.
Well, that is a Wordsworthian.
You think that's Wordsworthian, not from Whitman?
Whitman would not have minded, and Whitman is the poet of everyone.
Yeah, and he includes every hierarchy within the same poem.
And turns them into, and this is a favorite image in Whitman, wheels.
Right.
Wordsworth is interested in particular in beggars,
uh-huh.
in degraded or very low status or unfortunate people, because Wordsworth is more interested in extremely unfortunate or degraded human beings than he is in other human beings, because he thinks there's a truth about general human nature
mm-hmm.
that we can determine only by looking at beggars and very disabled elderly people.
The beggar is actually the one thing that in this poem that strikes me as way too literary. For a guy who wrote poems that didn't seem literary at all, this one, it doesn't strike me as a real beggar that he experienced. It's a literary beggar.
It is a literary beggar, that's right. And you do not see people like that in the poems that Ammons is writing later. There are often stretches, dozens and dozens of pages in Ammons, where, except for the first-person pronoun indicating the poet himself, there are no people. Ammons seems to have been unusually happy to be by himself and contemplate non-human nature, and that's the source of many of his greatest poems.
There's a poem called Sunday at McDonald's that you mentioned in your piece.
Mm-hmm.
McDonald's, the restaurant. I can't think of a place that's further removed from nature than a McDonald's restaurant. But he turns it into a nature poem. And I'm wondering if you could introduce this a little bit and then read it for us.
I would love to read that one for you. In Sunday at McDonald's, he acknowledges that the restaurant, McDonald's, may be appalling in its cartoonish plastic fixings. And he also acknowledges that we may be appalled to realize that we are going to die and this plastic stuff is going to be around when we're not. And he acknowledges, I think, also that we may be appalled that the trees might die, the sort of beautiful nature the Park Service preserves might go away and McDonald's with all of its red and yellow plastic remains. He acknowledges that in a few lines and then moves past it to tell us everything, even at McDonald's, is an example of the operation of the non-teleological laws of physics and chemistry. And we may need to see nature that way, the way that the laws of physics and the laws of chemistry will ask us to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Sunday at McDonald's, from his book, A Coast of Trees.
Mm-hmm.
In the bleak land of foreverness, no one lives but only crushed and buffeted now, 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 every star glints, perishing while now slides under and away, slippery as light, time vapor. What can butterflies do, or clear-eyed babies gumming French fries? Nature is holding them somehow, veering them off into growth holdings, forms brought to peaks of splendor, sharp energies burring into each other to set off new progressions through the rustle and mix, rot and slush. Is this the way it is? Sometimes a man will stand up, clear and settled as a bright day, and seem to look through the longest times and roilings to the still, star-bending, fixed ahead.
Yeah, and that man standing up seems to be the poet himself.
That does seem to be the poet.
Mm-hmm.
That is an example of the mature Ammons who has a lot in common in what he believes about the world and about language and about people. He has a lot in common with Whitman in what he believes, but he never sounds
like
Whitman.
No.
He doesn't sound like anyone except sometimes Williams.
Right.
But I also am seeing, and I want our listeners to see some of the strange things Ammons does with individual bits of language, such as the way that fixed,
mm-hmm.
the fixed, becomes a noun and not an adjective.
The still, star-bending, fixed ahead.
I think that the noun there is fixed.
Yep,
something
yeah.
called the fixed is what is ahead.
I don't know about you, but I've never had such a transcendent moment in a McDonald's. But here he is in the McDonald's, and yet there's no indication of people except for the babies gumming French fries. It's almost as if he is seeing through the people, through McDonald's, into something totally different.
That's right. Helen Bendler, I believe the first time she writes about Ammons, says that Ammons figures out how to make an interesting and a memorable poetry without two key resources which most poets need, and those resources are people and adjectives. Now, that's not literally true of the entire body of work. There are some people and there are plenty of adjectives, but very often in Ammons there will be a stretch of beautiful poetry with neither. And Ammons's training in the natural sciences, his ability to really see the world as holding the kind of non-teleological pattern scientists discover, enabled him to write a poetry that didn't need people or adjectives, that could just have nouns and verbs and gerunds and syntax and argument about how to see the patterns in non-human nature.
Mm-hmm.
He does have poems where he does think about people. Interestingly, they are usually marginal people. If they're not babies, they are the old. They are the elderly.
Yeah, and there's one really wonderful poem that you mentioned in your article that I want to see if I can get you to read. It's called Sweetened Change. And it reminded me so much of my own parents who are in a similar situation. But it is extremely human. It's totally focused on the people that are in the poem. Could you set this up and read it for us?
This is a poem that seems to have come from Ammons simply watching an elderly gentleman help his wife, who needs a wheelchair, get out of a car and into the wheelchair and then into a hospital.
Yeah, and that's it. That's the poem.
That's it.
Yeah, go ahead and read it.
Sweetened Change. The small white-headed man pops out his side and begins the 10-minute procedure of getting her out the car. He unloads the wheelchair first. The wife, Snow White, gets turned around, the toes so carefully tender and tended till she sits looking as if headed sideways. She finds in herself weight's structure and, rising, falls translated to the wheels. Such satisfaction and relief. But now the leg must be elevated, billows and strings, and special consideration given the spine's new crimp. It all works out, some tucking in and looking around. Off they roll through the hospital doors. Soon the quick man is out again, squeals away to parking spaces allotted longer stalls of time. He jogs back by and back through the doors he goes. One mate gives out and the other buzzes fast to sing he's not alone and idle.
That's a wonderful poem.
It is.
Stephen Burt, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stephen Burt wrote A Reading Guide to A.R. Ammons. That's on our website, poetryfoundation.org. He's a poet and critic, and he teaches at Harvard. We want to hear what you think of this program. Write a review in the iTunes store or email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. for Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.